It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. Today, the Thousand and One Nights come back to life. A touchstone of Arab culture, they're some of the oldest and most enchanting stories ever told. They're also sexually explicit, graphically violent, and surprisingly relevant today.
I'll be a Shahrazad till it knew each night.
Changed the course of a young man's life. A young man who liked his life was more than what he seemed.
Now you only got 1,000 more tales to tell him.
Ali Baba and the 40 Thieves. Ali Baba and the 40 Thieves. Ali Baba and the 40 Thieves.
So you know these stories, right? Alibaba and the 40 Thieves, Sinbad, Aladdin, flying carpets and magic lamps. The 1001 Nights are known in the West as the Arabian Nights, stories that have been told and retold for centuries, censored and banned in the Middle East, and made into cheesy Disney movies for kids. But have you ever actually read them? Today, three brilliant writers, Orhan Pamuk, Hanan al-Sheikh, and Salman Rushdie, reclaim the power of the originals. First, with the backstory, here's Steve Paulson.
One of the great things about the Arabian Nights is they appeal to very different audiences. For kids, they're full of exotic and magical creatures, but they're also complicated stories for adults, full of sex and intrigue and even murder. TV producer Shabnam Rezai grew up with these stories in Iran, and she's never forgotten them.
The story goes that the king comes home one day and he finds his wife in bed with all these slaves, and of course she's cheating on him, so he's enraged and he goes into a mad fit and takes out his sword and kills her right there and kills all the slaves. And beyond that, he gets really upset and puts out a decree that says, I'm going to take a virgin wife every night and kill her the next morning.
Because he doesn't think he can trust any women.
Women can no longer be trusted, that's right. So now we have a situation where he goes through all the virgin women in the town and they're all dead and we're only left with one woman, and this is Shahrazad, or Shahrazad, as you say, the daughter of the vizier. The night before she goes in, she asks her little sister, Donyazad, to come into the bedroom and ask for a bedtime story. And of course, that night, after the king is done with Shahrazad, Donyazad comes in and says, Sister, it's your last night on this earth. Would you mind parting with us with a good bedtime story? Now, what's very clever about Shahrazad is that she doesn't tell the ending of the story. So right at that cliffhanging moment where we're dying to find out if our hero is going to die or survive this ordeal, she says, you know what, guys? I am a little tired right now and the sun is about to come up. So why don't we take a break and we can follow the rest of this tomorrow.
Sort of like the template of every TV drama.
Absolutely.
You know, it always ends with the cliffhanger.
Is this not the most modern version of the commercial break?
Mm-hmm.
You know, every time you go out on a TV show that you're watching, they always give you that cliffhanger. And it was invented in the 9th century. I mean, it's brilliant.
She's the ultimate entertainer, the wonderful tailspinner. And one of the things that's difficult when you're trying to write about the Arabian Nights is that the stories are complicated.
Marina Warner is a cultural historian whose book about the Arabian Nights is called Stranger Magic.
They're subtle and ingenious, and the way the details and the plot unfold are definitely in the hands of a skillful embroiderer.
Night after night, Shahrazad stayed alive and kept her head on her shoulders. At last, after 1,001 nights had gone by, the king turned to her and said, Shahrazad, I shall never grow tired of you, and you shall be my queen for as long as we both shall live.
There's something irresistible about the Arabian Nights. It's not just the narrative structure, the stories within stories, or the triumph of Shahrazad in a man's world. It's this whole fantastic universe. I mean, think about it. Centuries before Harry Potter gave us flying cars and floating chandeliers, These were stories packed full of magic.
The djinn, you know, who are the genies who drive the action and who are good and bad. They can go both ways, so they're wonderfully unpredictable. The flying carpet, all the enchanted objects, all this landscape of possibilities opened up doors for people to imagine other worlds.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the cosmology of the Arabian Nights, the djinn. We now often refer to these characters as genies. What role do they play in these stories?
They're rather like our fairies. So whereas we think of as fairies as part of the past, the genies and the djinn of the nights are canonical. They're in the Quran. They're made of shimmering fire, or they're made of water. I mean, they're elemental. They have charge of the wind. They're kind of airy beings. And one of their tasks in the legends and the mythology of Islam is that they carry Solomon through the air on his throne.
Solomon is the all-wise king who presides over this world.
Yes, yes. Solomon is just like the Solomon in the Bible, except he's got more extraordinary stories attached to him in the Arabian Nights. He's the master of the jinn. And because, and the disobedient jinn, the ones who refuse to acknowledge the truth of Allah after the revelation of the Prophet, and the way they're punished is that Solomon shuts them up in copper bottles and tosses them into the depths of the ocean. And that, as you will remember, is the beginning of the famous scene when the fisherman fishes up one of these copper bottles and it's all covered in barnacles and rust. And he opens it and out swarms this huge pillar of fire, which is the imprisoned genie, and he will give the fisherman everything he wants.
So what'll it be, Master?
You're gonna grant me any three wishes I want, right?
Almost. There are a few provisos, a couple of quid pro quos.
Like?
Rule number one, I can't kill anybody.
Yeah, so don't ask.
Rule number two, I can't make anybody fall in love with anybody else. You little punim there.
Over the last decade, the Arabian Nights have become the subject of intense scholarly interest. There's no better example of how Middle Eastern culture was absorbed by Europeans and how it all got mixed up together to create something new. In fact, Shebnam Rezai says the title of these stories, The Arabian Nights, is actually misleading.
The original tales are called A Thousand and One Nights. And what happened was when they were first brought over to Europe for the first time in the 18th century, the French translators wanted to make it sound exotic. So they called it the Arabian Nights because it was conjuring up Arabia and, you know, maybe women in belly dancing outfits and hookah pipes. In fact, in Persian and in Arabic and in any other language, if you come across the works, they are called 1001 Nights. And the reason 1001 Nights is so much more appropriate is because the book started out in Persia, but then Arab scholars added to it, Indians, Chinese. The most famous stories, Aladdin, Ali Baba, and Sinbad, were added in France by the translators.
Oh, that's interesting. So those were not originally stories that came out of Iran? I mean, the most famous ones,
right.
Sinbad, Aladdin?
Yeah, so in 18th century France, there was a writer and a publisher who became very successful. He was publishing one story a day, and he had this little kiosk, and people would line up around the corner to buy these stories from him. And at the time, there were only 283 stories. So by the time the 284th day came along and he'd run out of stories, he panicked and went to the writer and said, I don't have any more stories to sell. And the writer said, well, that's it. I've translated everything. He said, well, guess what? You're going to have to write a couple more for me because these are selling like hotcakes. Huh. And that's what happened.
So here's the most fascinating part of the whole story. The reason we know the Arabian Nights, or if you prefer, 1001 Nights, the reason they're now part of the canon of world literature is because Europeans fell in love with them. In fact, added to them, even remade them at a time when the Arab world had never considered them anything more than folktales.
It is a European phenomenon.
Mohsen al-Massawi, a prominent scholar of Arabic literature.
Because among the elitist circles in the Arab world until some time in the 13th century, they thought of these kind of tales as unworthy of being written down. The popular was marginalized, was put aside. It was for the street, for the coffee house audiences, that's all. It was only in Europe, and it was very popular, certainly, with the French. But it was in England that it made its enormous reputation.
So you're saying this is a book that had enormous cultural influence over
the
centuries.
Next to the Bible.
And it wasn't just England. Throughout Europe, people were obsessed with what you might call Oriental exoticism. You find it in the operas of Mozart and the books of Europe's most famous writers. For instance, Voltaire's picaresque novel Candide would be unthinkable without the influence of the Arabian Nights.
You know, there are lots of fairy tales in the world, there are lots of myths in the world, but the Arabian Nights had a very special impact in 18th century Europe. They were just taken up by every kind of writer, artist, opera writer, you know, and then in the streets people began drinking coffee, people in their houses began wearing embroidered dressing gowns and turbans. You know, if you look at an 18th century portrait of a kind of writer or a nobleman, he will often be wearing a turban and a Turkish dressing gown. And also, above all, this is what really interested me, there's a freedom.
A freedom to step into a fantasy. What's so striking about the European craze for the Arabian Nights is when it happened. In the 18th century, during the Enlightenment, just as the scientific revolution was exploding all across Europe, when rationality finally seemed to knock religion off its pedestal, so people no longer had to believe in the Bible's miracles. But here you have the Arabian Nights with their flying carpets and magic lamps and genies, which must have given people the sense that a world without God could still feel magical and fantastical, strictly through the power of their imagination. Of course, there's also a politics to all of this, and the risk of stereotyping Muslims and Arabs as exotic characters right out of a fairy tale. But even Edward Said, the Palestinian-American cultural critic who wrote the landmark book Orientalism, had a soft spot for the Arabian Nights. He was never willing to write them off as just another example of how the West had colonized the Middle East. And it's one reason people who come from the Middle East have gone back to the Arabian Nights, even to turn them into TV shows for kids.
1001 nights, remarkable sights, with sultans and kings and with magical things from the past.
That's a scene from Big Bad Boo's animated TV series, 1001 Nights, which has aired in dozens of countries around the world, including the Middle East. Shabnam Rezai is the president of her production company.
I'm originally from Iran, and growing up, my father would tell me the tales late at night, and much like Shahrzad, the heroine, who doesn't tell the ending of the story, my father would keep the ending of the story from me, and so I would always be excited for the next night where I had the opportunity to sit with him and hear the rest of the story. So there's great tradition, oral tradition, in passing the stories down from generation to generation.
So you grew up with these stories. Now you live in the United States and also Canada. Why turn them into entertainment for today's children?
Our whole company, Big Bad Boo, is based on the mission and vision of teaching children about different cultures through entertainment. So the idea is to normalize being from a different country. So what's great about 1001 Nights is there are hundreds and hundreds of stories that conjure up genies, viziers, mermaids, evil emperors, and the world is really endless. And in the tradition of 1001 Nights, we are able to embellish and really use our imagination to create something that is modern and appropriate for today's audience.
But Shahrzad, what happened to the flying carpet? I liked that part.
Ah, that's a very good question, Shahzaman. But that would be another story.
Oh, come on!
Please!
Our backstory on the Arabian Nights, or the 1001 Nights, from Steve Paulson. You know, it's not just writers. So many composers, especially the French and Russians, were inspired by the 1001 Nights. What we're hearing right now is from Rimsky-Korsakov's Scheherazade, that solo violin line. The composer said that's Scheherazade herself telling her wondrous tales to the stern Sultan. Scheherazade is such a romantic figure. The beautiful and wise young woman who saves her own life by telling stories. And kind of like Scheherazade herself, those stories live on. The Lebanese novelist Hanan al-Sheikh has just retold some of them. She says she first heard the 1001 Nights as a child, rediscovered them years later, and now she considers Scheherazade the world's first feminist.
Yeah, I heard them on the radio when I was 8 or 7 years old. And then I was mesmerized by what I heard. Later, I started reading stories here and there. And finally, because when I was translated into other languages, people always thought that I am the new Shahrazad. And I used to be very offended.
Wait, people called you the new Shahrazad?
In the West, especially in the West, yeah.
And this was after you had begun publishing fiction?
Yeah, they started to call me the new Shahrazad. And I thought, no, I'm not that slave who tried to save herself by telling the king stories. And she was captured and confined in his palace. No, she should have poisoned him. This is what I thought then. And finished with him. But later, when I read the whole 2,000 pages of the book, I said, no, of course, it's the best compliment. They call me new Shahrazad. Shahrazad is the mother of all of us, and she is the feminist number one.
So I'm curious about the role these stories, and Shahrazad's story in particular, has played in the Arab world, because, as you said, she's actually a very powerful woman. Has that made problems for these stories?
Yes, of course. In the Arab world, 1001 Night, as we call it, Alf Layla wa Layla, was censored. It was banned. Even it was banned 6 years ago in Egypt. And 500 lawyers defended the book, 1001 Night, until it was in bookstores again. And it was cut. And they took so many sections, especially the explicitness and the sexuality.
I can't imagine that those stories, ancient and foundational as they are, play very well amongst fundamentalist Muslims today.
Yes, of course. I'm sure they haven't read them. They haven't read them. And unfortunately, I don't think many Arabs read them. They think 1001 Night is a book about clichés, not very important. And because of the language, they think it's a simple language. But this is the beauty of the book, its simplicity, because people talked and wrote as they thought. They didn't grab a dictionary or, you know, tried their best to write amazing literature. No. They were the language of the people who wants to listen and to hear every night a story.
So are the 1001 Nights still relevant today?
Everywhere in the world. Yes. Everywhere. Because people wants to live in harmony, although in spite of wars, in spite of the mischief of, you know, of everything. The religion is really overshadowing and overwhelming the Middle East nowadays. And when one goes back to these stories, especially in the Arab world, they'll say, oh, my God, we were really different. We could talk to a ruler. We could change minds. We could fight for our rights. And maybe we should learn from these stories.
Mm. It's funny, I kept thinking, wow, the more things change, the more they stay the same. I mean, you know, think about the situation in the Middle East today with a powerful dictator in Syria and a lot of people being killed. How different are things?
Yes, especially I wish that all presidents and kings and rulers in the Arab world would go back to 1001 Night and see how the rulers before were, how they treated their subjects. And even when they were savages sometimes and very hard, and like King Shahrayar, they should learn from them. The caliph, when the five sisters told him that we're not going to get married, and one of them said, I'm not going to marry you, and they fought and they struggled, everything, he said, yes, you have a point here. You have a point. You want to stay single because you suffered on the hands of men. Yes, I guarantee that. You are free to do that. Nowadays, there isn't anything like that.
Well, and these stories are so magical, too. I mean, flying carpets, magic lamps. Are they still relevant in the Arab world today, do you think?
Yes, in a way, yes. But they can, but also they should be hand in hand with justice and democracy and equality, with the magic. I mean, what is magic? Magic is when you feel happiness and something extraordinary, something you want to share with others, and without any religion influence and no segregation. And the first proof of Shahrazad, that because she read a lot and she knew about many, many things, in a way we learned from her. And yes, magic is important, but also magic, if it is rooted in reality, will be more important as well.
Hanan, before we go, is there one of the stories that you retold that you could share with us?
Well, I changed a few stories, and I wanted to include something about birds, and here it is. I forgot completely about this bird until a few days later, when I went down to the manna from heaven trees by the pond to find out whether the manna was ripe. In the distance, I could see the enormous, colorful bird drinking from the pond. To my astonishment, I watched as the bird started to shake and shake until a man emerged from beneath its feathers. I put my hand to my mouth, gasping and suppressing a scream of confusion and amazement. I walked towards him as though hypnotized, feeling no fear. The man was looking at the house and did not seem to have noticed me. He was not like any other man I had ever encountered. He was so beautiful. He had a face like the crescent moon, with rosy cheeks and eyes like those of a houri, as if God had created him to bewitch and enchant. Then he entered his feathers again and flew away, leaving me to stare at the sky, speechless. When I climbed into bed that night and shut my eyes, I saw only him, as if he stayed beneath my lids the whole night long. In the morning, I rushed to the pond. The same bird flew back, landed, shook and shook. And when he had become a man, he saw me standing not far from him. He smiled at me, and I reached out and touched his feathers, which were soft and beautifully decorated. "Who are you, and what are you doing here?" I asked him. "But have you forgotten that you yourself invited me? Did I not hear you say the other night as you sat with your sisters, 'Where is the man who would not deceive me and steal my money? Show him to me, for God's sake.' I am that man you called for, and I hurried to comply with your wishes. I am planning to have you sleep in a bed of gold, eat from golden plates, and bathe in water of gold." That's it.
I don't know whether to be pleased that there's a story in which a man and a woman finally can be happy together, or or sad because such a man can only be a magical creature from a fairy tale.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Mm. Hanan, thank you so much for talking today.
Thank you.
Novelist Hanan Al-Sheikh's new collection of stories is called 1001 Nights, a retelling. Hanan was raised in Beirut, and her novels include The Story of Zara. And we're listening to music from another Western composer inspired by the 1001 Nights. This is from Maurice Ravel's Scheherazade Overture. Coming up, writers Orhan Pamuk and Salman Rushdie bring the Arabian Nights into the present. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. We're talking about one of the most famous pieces of world literature in this hour, the 1001 Nights, or as they're also known, the Arabian Nights. How relevant are these stories today? Well, they're still a powerful influence for some very famous writers.
I am Orhan Pamuk. I first read Arabian Nights when I was 7 because my aunt gave me a popularized children's version of it. Even at the age of 8, I was scared by it because there were all these Arabs, harems, a lot of betrayal, a lot of jinns getting out of the lamps. I also remember distinctly reading Ali Baba and the Shadowy Cave. And also, in my childhood, when I first read Arabian Nights, I was upset by it, finding it too orientalist, too sugary. And being a Turkish secular, I didn't like it. Cut. Then, 40 years later, I'm an intellectual, Borgesian, Calvino, postmodern literature. I said to myself, why don't I have a new look at Arabian Nights? And then there were also ambitious publishers asking for introductions from me and doing a new translation of the whole text. And I wrote an introduction. And this time, I found it very literary, box in a box in a box, in suggestiveness of a Borgesian text. But this time, I found it a strange text about women. Women are not good in Arabian. They are always cunning, always making manipulative plots and conspiracies. That upset me in a second reading. Then I also learned that two of the most prominent stories, Ali Baba, Aladdin, may not actually be in Arabic, but translators may have added this to the compilation, remind me of the fact that, yes, Arabian Nights is an Arabic book, but there is also a lot of French editing and influence in it. If you are asking me if Arabian Nights influenced me, I would say, what is influence? The greatest influence is it influences your style, the way you look at things. It didn't influence me that way. But it's a text that I borrow things from that influenced me in that way, such as doubles, what the Germans call Doppelgänger, the fact that we may have it someone like us, or the theme of the Sultan who is walking around at night in disguise. This is a very medieval, not necessarily Islamic thing, because there was no photography and the rulers were not recognized, so they're checking in themselves, their country. This is a theme which plays a lot in Arabian Nights and which has a lot of space in my novels too. I sometimes obviously say I'm borrowing it from Arabian Nights. But is that an influence or more borrowing? In fact, tongue-in-cheek borrowing is sort of inventing a tradition and saying to my Turkish readers or international readers, this was done by Arabian Nights, but this is my take on the subject.
Orhan Pamuk talking about the 1001 Nights. He won a Nobel Prize for Literature in 2006, and he lives and writes in his native Istanbul. You know, the first stories in the 1001 Nights were written down in the 9th century, but there's a long tradition of writers who've added to them. In some ways, it's not so much a book as a living river of stories, and the most recent additions come from the celebrated novelist Salman Rushdie. Years ago, when his first son was young, he wrote a children's novel called Harun and the Magic Sea, full of genies and magic carpets and flying ships. More recently, he came out with a sequel of sorts called Luca and the Fire of Life. In an interview a few years ago, he told Jim Fleming he wrote it because his second son insisted.
Yes, he more or less did. I mean, actually, when he was born, I already had a good suspicion that I would probably at some point myself want to write a companion volume to Harun and the Sea of Stories, which I'd written for his older brother. But then when he was about, I guess, 9.5, 10 years old maybe, he read Harun and was fond of it, but was very clear that it had been written for his older brother, and that created an injustice in the family, which it was important that I rectify. And he began to be more and more vehement on that subject, so I had no option really but to do what he said. Everyone in Kahani was fully aware that there was a world of magic existing in parallel with our own non-magic one, And from that reality came white magic, black magic, dreams, nightmares, stories, lies, dragons, fairies, blue-bearded genies, mechanical mind-reading birds, buried treasure, music, fiction, hope, fear, the gift of eternal life, the angel of death, the angel of love, interruptions, jokes, good ideas, rotten ideas, happy endings. In fact, almost everything of any interest at all.
This is also a place that you know a great deal about. This is more or less the same magic world that Harun entered, isn't it?
Well, it's related to it, yes. I mean, if we're going to be completely topographically exact about it, the Sea of Stories exists on Earth's invisible second moon, obviously. But in this book, the torrent of words actually gushes down from the Sea of Stories to the Earth. The torrent of words, by the way, thunders down from the Sea of Stories into the Lake of Wisdom, whose waters are illumined by the dawn of days and out of which flows the River of Time. The Lake of Wisdom, as is well known, stands in the shadow of the Mountain of Knowledge, at whose summit burns the fire of life. This important information regarding the layout and, in fact, the very existence of the magical world was kept hidden for thousands of years, guarded by mysterious, cloaked spoilsports who called themselves the Alim, or Learned One. I mean, I think it's one of the things you have to do. When you're creating an imaginary world, you do have to know how it looks. And I think the more precise you are about that, the more realistic and believable you can make that world feel. So yeah, I had a map of my imaginary world in my head.
But you also have a son who has grown up with video games, and there is that kind of world. What do you call them? At some point you say that they are like pocket universes.
Yes, miniature alternative realities that you could carry around in your pocket and then just plunge into. Once upon a time, we used to call those books. now, but what I thought was helpful was the video game, or certain kind of video game, is structured very similarly to the quest narrative. The so-called levels of the video game correspond quite well to the stages of the hero and the quest, you know, even from Pilgrim's Progress onwards. You know, it's not often you can use the words Pilgrim's Progress and Super Mario in the same sentence. And then, of course, the quest story itself, the way in which quests work, whether it's for the Holy Grail or whether it's Beowulf defeating the monster Grendel and then the monster's mother and so on. There's a structure there which is a very helpful shape. Of course, Luca knew all about the world of magic. He had grown up hearing about it from his father every day, and he had believed in it. He had even drawn maps and painted pictures of it, the torrent of words flowing into the Lake of Wisdom, the Mountain of Knowledge and the Fire of Life. All that stuff. But he hadn't believed in it in the way that he believed in dining tables or streets or stomach upsets. It hadn't been real in the way that love was real or unhappiness or fear. It was only real in the way that stories were real while you were reading them, or heat mirages before you got too close to them, or dreams while you were dreaming. Well, I think it's a mistake to believe that the real world is devoid of magic. For instance, one of the things that artists have always believed is that we get dulled by just habituation, by the dailiness of life. We cease to perceive the world as wonderful, whereas actually the world is filled with daily wonders. You know, and one of the things that art can do, I think, is to restore our sense of how wonderful the world in which we live really is. So that's one thing. And I mean, the other thing is, I think the world of the imagination has always been very closely related to what we might call the real world. Everything has to be imagined before it comes into being. You know, somebody has to imagine a radio transmitter before we can have this conversation. You have to imagine the wheel before you can make the wheel. You have to imagine the hyperlink before you can have the World Wide Web. So things constantly move across that border from the imagined world into the real.
Luca, at some point in the book, tells one of the ancient gods, and I think this is a quote, it's only through stories that you can get out into the real world and have some sort of power again.
Exactly. I mean, that's, of course, the sad fate of discarded gods. I mean, I have some fun with it in the book, that you have these deities who were once, you know, supreme deities, Zeus, Ra, all these people who the world lived in fear and trembling, you know, beneath their power. And then they suddenly get discarded, and now they end up in some kind of theme park or retirement home for ex-gods. It's a sad fate.
Can stories really make things possible? I mean, most of us live lives in which we pay mortgages, we pay car loans. You lived in hiding for a decade from death threats, and yet you've managed to hold on to this sense of enchantment, to this the glory of storytelling. That has to be hard sometimes, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, writing is hard. I mean, I remember when my sister tried to write a cookbook and she kept complaining about how hard it was. And I said, well, yes, it is hard. You know? Nobody said it wasn't. You know? Well, I think two things. First of all, that you're right that there is a real world which is not like this enchanted world. And I think in Luca and the Fire of Life, Luca's mother, Soraya, is the one with her feet on the ground who keeps mentioning that. You know, she keeps saying that, you know, really it's more important to do your math homework than to be great at a video game. And that in the real world, as she says, there are no levels, there are only difficulties. You know, no matter how good you are at the world of magic, at the world of imagination and play, you actually do have to face the difficulties of the real world. So I think that's true. But it's also true, I think, that we are creatures who live by stories. You know, human beings always have. And it's very close to the heart of our nature. As somebody says in the book, you know, man alone is the storytelling animal. Nobody else does it. And so, yes, you have to balance those two. But there's no doubt the real world exists. And that's, you know, in a way, the given of this book is that death really exists. You know, and this boy, Luca, realizes that his father, who only has one life, not the 1,001 lives that you can collect in a video game and spend with great profligacy, the person who matters most to him only has one life, and that life is ebbing away, and he has to try and save it. So again, there, you know, there's a deliberate attempt in the novel to contrast the world of the game, in which life is cheap and plentiful and can be replenished, with the real world in which life is dear and valuable and there's only one of it and it can't be replenished. So that contrast is very much at the heart of the book between the real and the fantastic.
Salman Rushdie talking with Jim Fleming about his children's novel, Luca and the Fire of Life. If you want to hear more about the 1001 Nights, you'll find longer interviews on our website at ttbook.org. And coming up, we've got a new feature called On Our Minds and a Dangerous Idea. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
You are about to experience a totally new dimension and
ideas, the intellectual thrill ride of the year. To the Best of Our Knowledge proudly presents
Dangerous
Ideas.
Chuck Klosterman.
There is one stupid idea that towers above all others. In practice, its impact is minor. In theory, it's the most f***ed up meaty construction spawned by the 20th century. And I've felt this way for almost my entire life. I can't think of anything philosophically stupider than laugh tracks. Perhaps this seems like a shallow complaint to you, Perhaps you think that railing against canned laughter is like complaining that nuclear detonations are bad for the local bunny population. I don't care. Go read a vampire novel. It will always seem stupid because canned laughter represents the worst qualities of insecure people. Now, I realize these qualities can be seen everywhere in life and within lots of complicated contexts. Insecurity is part of being alive. But it's never less complicated than this. It's never less complicated than a machine that tries to make you feel like you're already enjoying something simply because other people you'll never meet were convinced to laugh at something else entirely. But canned laughter is a lucid manifestation of an anxious culture that doesn't know what is and isn't funny. If you've spent any time trolling the blogosphere, you've probably noticed a peculiar literary trend, the pervasive habit of writers inexplicably placing exclamation points at the end of otherwise unremarkable sentences. Sort of like this. It is done to suggest an ironic detachment from the writing of an expository sentence. It's supposed to signify that the writer is self-aware. And this is idiotic. It's the saddest kind of failure. All those extraneous exclamation points are like little splatters of canned laughter. They represent the form of funny, which is more easily understood and much more easily constructed than authentic funniness. Build a machine that tells people when to cry. That's what we need. We need more crying.
And that is Chuck Klosterman's Dangerous Idea. You'll find more dangerous ideas and interviews with Klosterman on our website at ttbook.org. And now it's time for On Our Minds. This week, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan are back on our minds, partly because former Defense Secretary Robert Gates is on the circuit, promoting his new memoir. Well, for a different take, there's another insider's account that's also just out, but getting less attention. Eric Prince's Civilian Warriors. Prince was the founder and CEO of Blackwater, called private military contractors by some and mercenaries by others. Blackwater faced lawsuits and a congressional inquiry into its conduct. Steve Paulson recently sat down to talk with Eric Prince.
Do you have any regrets for what Blackwater did in Iraq?
I wish that we had not worked for the State Department. I think for the amount of pain and hassle and legal jeopardy that it put our people in, that's just not worth it. I wish that we'd insisted on cameras. I mean, if I could say one tactical thing we'd have done different immediately, it would have put cameras, you know, cruiser cams in each of the vehicles. It would have protected the civilians, it would have protected our people, and it would have protected the company from exactly the he said, she said kind of scenarios that critics are very quick to throw at us.
Let me follow up on what you said about the State Department. I mean, that's really interesting. You're saying that you wish you had not worked for the State Department, and yet you were hired. I mean, you were paid a lot of money, over $1 billion in total by the U.S. government, largely by the State Department. You're saying that wasn't worth it?
No. I mean, personally, professionally, all the rest, in hindsight, it wasn't. But again, if we'd been on the job in Benghazi, I do believe the U.S. ambassador would still be alive. Good security, good vigilance matters.
Yeah. So if it wasn't worth it, why didn't you stop?
Well, I didn't know. I guess, we, being from the special operations background, understood enemy risk and logistics challenges and weather and all those kind of things that amass against you and you adjust for those. But the rear echelon politics of it all and the hot air that comes from Washington that turns into a blast furnace, we had no idea it could become that direct and that, I would say, irrational to burn a business down that you've grown really for the sake of politics is, it's a cautionary tale for the next entrepreneur that may be running to the sound of the alarm bell to watch out that the tides can change very quickly.
Well, you have a perspective on the wars the United States has fought in both Iraq and Afghanistan that very few Americans have. And I guess I'm wondering, what do American citizens need to know about the way these wars are fought that we may not realize?
Unfortunately, the U.S. has mastered the most expensive way to wage war. I saw an alarming figure last week that showed the Pentagon budgeting $2.1 million per trooper in Afghanistan. That is an alarmingly high number, an alarmingly unsustainable number. And, you know, that's why I'm, you know, I towards the end of the book, I make the case for cutting the budget, for reducing the defense budget, reducing the intelligence budget, because it's become so large, so bloated, that to the point of being detrimental to the effectiveness of those organizations. So the private sector can at least measure, again, benchmark against for what things should really cost. You know, if you want to overnight a letter from coast to coast, you can go to the Postal Service and do it, or you can go to FedEx, or you can go to UPS, and you can get an immediate price check. In the same way, for putting someone in the field, for the cost of a person operating in Afghanistan with the food, the fuel, the ammunition, whatever they might need, there's ways the government can do that themselves, and there's certainly ways that someone could bid it to do it by themselves and, again, get a price check. So I'm not advocating certainly privatizing the military altogether, but certainly the private sector operating around the periphery can give some reality to these prices, because $2.1 million per trooper is just wrong.
What about the larger war on terror, which has marked all of our lives since 9/11? Has this gone too far?
Look, clearly there are people trying to kill us. I think one of the reasons for the very tepid preparations in Benghazi is because it was not fitting the administration's paradigm that al-Qaeda was defeated and on its back heel and peace, love, and happiness was breaking out around the world. Clearly, there are plenty of radicals that want to destroy Western civilization and want to impose their weird form of life upon the rest of us. And so we have to be vigilant in minimizing their ability to do that. I don't know that we ever want to live in a country that is 100% free from risk, because I think that country starts to look more like North Korea. Let's stop trading our liberty for a false sense of security. And that even extends to, I think, real overreach by the NSA collecting information on Americans. That's probably not necessary, and I think way too prone to abuse, because I think there's very, very weak oversight from congressional committees. They really don't know to what extent these government entities are operating.
Are you glad that Edward Snowden released all those private documents showing the level of surveillance?
I don't know what the level of exposure he did, but I do think it's at least important to have a rational, real conversation about those kind of disclosures and to what extent do we do that. You know, I know a lot of Germans who are flat out worried, petrified about that, because they, you know, a lot of East Germans, a third of Germany, lived under an extremely efficient surveillance state in East Germany. And they don't want to live like that again. And I sure don't want to live like that in America. And that's not what made America great.
Well, you said that there is the risk that the U.S. could become more like North Korea. I mean, if we really do give up our freedom.
If we keep, you know, I hate to see America overreact every time there's an incident to try to prevent that incident from happening again. And we keep putting up more walls and more bureaucracy every time. And so we just have to be mindful that, you know, as Margaret Thatcher once said, we have to be lucky every day. The terrorists only have to be lucky once. So don't overreact the next time there's a terrorist attack. Take it with a grain of salt that it's still far more dangerous to drive on the road on an average year. You have a greater chance of injury or death from that than you do from terrorism. So it's important for people to be rational about their fears of what's around the corner.
Well, to return to the role of your company, Blackwater, do you think Blackwater ever went too far in what you did in Iraq?
You know, tracking any kind of escalation of force incidents, is it possible a civilian was killed unnecessarily by a car accident or by a shooting or a ricochet? Yes. But I also know that burying our dead, receiving bodies back at Andrews or at Dover Air Force Base from guys that were killed in ambushes is the other side of that coin. That's the awful, awful side of that. And so that's a balance. And I feel terrible for the Iraqi people that lived under a dictator of Saddam, that lived under a civil war, that are still undergoing a sectarian civil war. And that's unfortunately the nature of war, that people suffer in the middle even while you're trying to make peace.
Well, it also sounds like you're saying that the way that wars are fought now, the way the United States fight wars you simply cannot do this without private contractors, without a lot of private contractors.
The U.S. government will not go to war without contractors again unless they institute a draft. Full stop. So when you think about the complexity of some of these weapon systems or of drones, it is easier and more adaptable to have contractors out in the field maintaining those instead of trying to keep uniformed services people doing it. There's all kinds of cost-benefit analysis to do on what those roles are. And I would say as you contemplate cutting back into the defense budget, I would encourage Congress to act more like a board of directors and appropriate the money to the service chiefs, albeit to a reduced number of service chiefs, and make them responsible for deciding what they buy and how many they need, and stop buying big weapon systems based on how many congressional districts it's based in. It's wrong, and that's why we spend way too much.
One final question. Suppose the U.S. is hit by another 9/11-type attack, and the United States is drawn into a new war in another country, and people you know from the CIA come to you and say, would you help? Would you start another Blackwater? We need you. Would you work for the government again?
You know, that's a tough question, sir. I don't know. I've had a few people ask me that. What would I do? And I really don't know. I'm, I guess once bitten, twice shy.
Eric Prince is the founder and former CEO of Blackwater. He sold the company in 2010. Steve Paulson talked with him about his new memoir, Civilian Warriors, The Inside Story of Blackwater. And that's what's on our minds today. But we post new On Our Minds segments on our website every day, and that's at ttbook.org. While you're there, check out our new flash fiction contest, 3-Minute Futures.
In a world where your food doesn't always taste like chicken.
Soylent Green is people.
In a world where our simian siblings have taken over.
You maniac!
To the best of our knowledge invites you to create your own world. Share your vision of the near future with 3-Minute Futures, a flash fiction contest. Best-selling science fiction novelist Kim Stanley Robinson will choose the top 3 stories. They will air on TT Book. For details, visit ttbook.org.
To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio. Charles Monroe Kane produced today's show with help from Doug Gordon, Sarah Nix, and Stephanie Youngblood. Our theme music comes from Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Carilla Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.